ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors at the ETF Store and sponsored by Legg Mason. Legg Mason's sponsorship is not an endorsement nor a recommendation for any product or service. Legg Mason Investor Services LLC is not affiliated with the ETF Store, ETF.com, or any of its affiliates. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. All investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. The ETF Store owns and is responsible for all program content. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Legg Mason is a leading global investment company committed to helping clients reach their financial goals through long-term actively managed strategies. Legg Mason offers a broad range of equity, fixed income, alternative, and cash strategies worldwide. It is comprised of a diverse family of specialized investment managers, each with their own independent approach to research and analysis, and has over a century of experience in identifying opportunities and delivering astute investment solutions to clients. To learn more, please visit LeggMason.com.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate and Connor will help you get up to date on what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, great show for you today. As always, I want to thank the exclusive sponsor of ETF Prime, Legg Mason. So last week, there were several pretty big headlines around ETF fees. On Monday, SoFi, who's an online personal financial services firm, probably best known for student loan refinancing, they filed for four ETFs with the SEC, two of which would be offered at zero cost. These would be the first free ETFs, the SoFi 500 ETF and the SoFi Next 500 ETF. Now, there was a bit of a catch here. The filings show there is a 0.19% fee for these two ETFs, but SoFi is actually waiving that fee until at least March of 2020. And so that raised some questions around whether or not this sticks longer term, right? Whether SoFi removes that fee waiver at some point. And Connor, this actually dovetails into what I think is becoming the larger story. And not just in ETFs, but really across the financial services industry, which is what does free even mean anymore, right? Because when Fidelity launched zero fee mutual funds last year, people immediately began wondering what the catch was. Is Fidelity just trying to lure people in the door and cross-sell them on more expensive funds or other services? We've seen the same thing in the commission-free trading space. Firms like Robinhood offering free trades, but then questions being raised on how they're routing those trades, that they're making money by selling the order flow. There's also a lot of discussion around the interest that brokerages are paying on cash sitting in investment accounts. So in just a moment, we're going to get into all of this with ETF.com's Dave Nottig. And look, let me say, I do think overall, there's no question investors have benefited. We know the costs of investing have come down across the board. I just wonder what we're sacrificing in transparency.
You know, when this SoFi news came out, everybody's immediate reaction was, you know, what's the catch here? And we'll get Dave's thoughts on that here in a second. But to your point, let's be clear here. Fees are coming down overall for investors. That is undoubtedly happening. New York Times actually had a piece last week. They showed that the average fee paid by stock index fund investors has come down nearly 40% over the past decade. And that's real.
Yeah,
and
that
that's from
real.
An already low starting point, because we're talking about index stock investing, right? Not actively managed investing. The problem is when investors start losing transparency. You know, there are all of these commission-free trading ETFs, right, on all the large brokerage accounts. Well, brokerage services, those are pay for play, you know, and perhaps you're paying a higher fund fee for that. Or like you just mentioned, the cash in your brokerage account isn't being paid the interest rate that it probably should. And to be honest, 2 years ago, this was a non-event because everybody was paying zero. But there's real yield now in cash in short-term investing that a lot of investors on some of these, you know, apps and new launches are really squeezing their investors on, paying them under market on their interest rate. Look, everybody acknowledges that these aren't nonprofits. These are for-profit entities, and they have every right to make money and be profitable. In this intense fee pressure, it's causing them to get creative. But that's where the issue with transparency problems can start cropping up when these firms are forced to get creative in how they do make any money.
Well, I want to play a quick clip here. Morningstar's Ben Johnson discussed this topic last week. Take a listen to this.
The explicit, very transparent fees that we see and we pay for investment products go ever lower, either approach zero or hit zero. More and more of sort of the cost of being an investor is going into the dark and becoming less explicit and more implicit. So I think that the poster child for this would be what are you earning on your cash account? Depending on the platform that you're at, you might be earning 0.01%. You might be earning 2.25%. There's a real opportunity cost there, and your opportunity cost is the means via which that platform, that organization that you're doing business with, is subsidizing things that are nominally free.
So I like that, subsidizing things that are nominally free. Ben said costs are going into the dark. They're less explicit and more implicit. And really, I think that's the crux of the issue. So again, we'll get into all of this with Dave Nuttig in just a moment. The other big story last week was we learned on Wednesday that Vanguard chopped fees on 10 ETFs, including some pretty popular ones, like their emerging market ETF, ticker VWO, and their all-world ex-US ETF, VEU. And it was just a basis point or two here and there. But I did a rough calc, and I came up with over $30 million in savings from these fee cuts alone, which is money that's simply going right back into investors' pockets. And then on Friday came word that Vanguard also lowered fees on three of the largest ETFs on the planet, including their S&P 500 ETF, VOO, and their total stock market ETF, VTI. We're going to be joined by CFRA's Todd Rosenbluth to discuss those fee cuts. And we'll also get his thoughts on this entire conversation around zero fee ETFs and commission free trading and this overall fee war. So look forward to that. And then later in the show, we have a great ETF spotlight, Simeon Hyman, who is global investment strategist at ProShares. He's going to spotlight their suite of dividend grower ETFs. So, for example, they offer an ETF that only owns S&P 500 companies that have increased dividends for at least 25 consecutive years. So we'll discuss the potential benefits of that approach and where this strategy might fit in a portfolio. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can visit etfprime.com or you can find me on Twitter at Nate Geraci. All right, let's start today with ETF.com's Dave Nuttig.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
People have been saying there are too many mutual funds since the 80s. For all the talk of smart beta, they haven't pulled in huge assets. The active managers are showing up in the ETF space.
Dave, so SoFi finally did it. They became the first company to file for zero-fee ETFs. I do believe Old Mutual had something back in the day, but we knew for a fact up front that the zero fee wasn't staying in place on that, or the fee waiver wasn't staying in place on that. Were you surprised at all that it was SoFi who made this move and not someone like Schwab or JP Morgan or another larger fund company?
I expected it to be an oddball who would be doing it to get some attention, and here we are talking about them, so I guess it's worked, right? So I wasn't that surprised. I was a little surprised that it was SoFi. I mean, it's a company that I knew only tangentially from the slightly odd world of, you know, student loan refinance, which I'm sure they're a perfectly honorable player in it, but that's obviously a fairly notorious part of the market where all sorts of shenanigans happen. So it was sort of an odd thing. It came on the backs of them announcing a bunch of other investment-related expansions to their platform, including some sort of quasi-free brokerage that they were offering a week or two before that. So it makes sense for them in the pattern of what they're doing for their business, but definitely makes them an oddball in the ETF space.
All right. You mentioned the word shenanigans, and these ETFs don't technically have a zero fee, right? There's actually a 19 basis point expense ratio, and then SoFi is waiving that until at least March of 2020. What do you make of that? Is this shenanigans, or do you think this fee waiver will stick?
This is pretty common. There are, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of ETFs that we report as having a 10, 20, 30 basis point fee, when in fact what you're getting is the fee waiver, right? There's a cap on that. And that's a common practice. There are plenty of iShares products that do that. You don't really see it in the Vanguard product suite, but other than that, pretty much universally, you'll see these fee waivers for new funds. And what that does is it lets them sort of maintain very traditional economics, right? They maintain their own books and their reporting, but then somebody steps up to cover the expenses until the fund gets big enough that it can sort of carry its own weight. So it's very, very common, but it does sort of make for interesting headlines, because when you put a waiver in that has an explicit end date, which these are 1 year out, I think on March 2020, from whenever they launched. So even if they launched, on February 2020, finally, it would only be a 1 month waiver. It's a little bit tough to call these really the first free ETF. So you kind of have to put some air quotes around the headline.
All right. So this is getting into the weeds a little bit, but it's interesting. SoFi isn't managing these funds in house. They brought on Mike Venuto and Taroso as the fund's advisor, and Tidal Growth is the administrator and owner of the trust, and then Exponential ETFs as a sub-advisor. I guess point being, those firms need to be paid, right? They're not doing this for free, right? There are real tangible costs here. And then you look at SoFi, as you mentioned, they recently launched a brokerage operation where they're touting free trading for stocks and ETFs. They also have a robo-advisor, which currently charges no management fees. So you put all this together. Here you have free ETFs, free trades, free robo-advice. How do they make money? What's the business model?
Well, so I think there's a couple things here. One is, yes, they have other services for which they do get paid, whether it's loan refinance, et cetera. And they're trying to establish relationships with customers. And that's a very traditional thing to do. Like, you put this loss leader out there to try to build a book of business, to build a customer base, and then you monetize it later. I mean, that's sort of the dot-com way, right? That's how we think about Twitter or Facebook or any number of huge internet companies have successfully used that strategy. There are plenty of companies that have unsuccessfully used the strategy too, and sort of put themselves out of business. So it's legit to be concerned about where they're actually getting paid, to the point of Ben Johnson's quote beforehand, you have to think about where else you might be paying.
Well, I will say, you mentioned the marketing. They got a ton of run from this in the major financial media. I mean, just within a few hours of the filings, and nothing else, by the way, right? Just SEC filings. Everyone was on this story. Barron's, Bloomberg, CNBC. I know
we wrote about it.
Yeah, ETF.com had a piece. So, that marketing pop is worth its weight in gold. Look, one of the challenges of offering zero-fee ETFs versus zero-fee mutual funds like Fidelity did is that anyone can buy them, whereas only Fidelity customers can buy the mutual funds. So let's say hypothetically, if billions of dollars come pouring into these SoFi ETFs, do you think that could change the calculus for SoFi in terms of the fee waiver?
Well, yeah. And I think also, as an investor, you do also need to ask yourself whether or not this is sort of a point of diminishing returns, right? Is a free quasi S&P 500 exposure, sort of their large cap, I think they're calling it the SoFi 500 or something like that, is the free there, really worth the difference versus, say, what is now the 3 basis points Vanguard S&P 500 ETF VOO? I mean, to put that in perspective, if you have a $100,000 investment, that's $30 a year in difference. And most people will spend $30 on pizza and a Coke and not even think about it. So I think there reaches a point where, free may actually be the wrong price.
Well, and I think on that note, something I've been thinking a lot about recently is, I worry that investors might get the impression there's some sort of catch involved with ETFs in general. So I just worry that when it appears there's some sort of a gimmick on free ETFs or free ETF trading, that might give all ETFs a bad name. Are you concerned at all about that, that we might be at a point where investors are wondering why their fund is so cheap and what the catch is?
I think it's absolutely right. So when the ETF industry starts getting out into these sort of slightly wackier corners, whether it's this no-fee issue, whether it's some of the more sort of aggressive trading-oriented triple leverage, this and that, those things do have a little bit of sort of a reputational contagion risk. And I also think the other side of that is if people start offering these things for free, well, people put value on things based on their prices. And if you're literally paying zero for your beta exposure, I actually think it's dangerous that that becomes the expectation because, frankly, there's real work that goes into running these funds and running them well. And, you know, to have the transparency of paying for what you're getting go away, again, just for Ben's point in the opening segment, I think this is actually a blow against transparency because these funds are not actually free. They cost money to run. They're simply choosing not to pass that cost on to investors.
Do you think we've gotten too greedy as investors? You know, we all agree lower costs are better, right? I mean, we all want lower costs. But to your point, fund companies are in the business of making money, right? They're for-profit operations. And with all the other businesses we interact with on a daily basis, look, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't feel like people are squeezing their local grocery store over milk prices or tightening the screws on their local restaurant. I feel like as consumers, we understand those places need to make money. And certainly we all want a good deal. We all want a fair deal. But have we gone overboard here in financial services?
Well, I think that, you know, the vanguardization of financial services is a real issue. You know, we have gotten used to, largely because of Vanguard, to the idea that the right price to pay is the lowest price, or perhaps the right price to pay is cost, right? Like what it actually costs for the thing that you're buying in financial services. And I actually think that's a little bit dangerous, right? Because there are operational issues. I personally would not feel comfortable sort of giving my money to a bank that I've never heard of. And, yeah, maybe it has the FDIC logo on the outside, but otherwise they just launched yesterday. I think most of us wouldn't be comfortable with that because we recognize the bank is doing stuff that's valuable. They're holding the money. They're paying the interest. They're going to be there when, you know, the you-know-what hits the fan. So I think financial services being priced at zero is not healthy.
All right, Dave, we have about 2 minutes left. I do want to make sure to end on a positive note here. I feel like we're being a little bit of a Debbie Downer. And Connor and I mentioned this at the top. I do think it's important to put all of this in context because overall there's no question the cost of investing has come down, whether fund fees or trading commissions or even investment advice. And I would say especially in the ETF space, right, investors have benefited. But, you know, we still have ridiculously pricey hedge funds and annuities and mutual funds. I just want to make sure we don't lose the forest for the trees. I guess on that note, any closing thoughts here?
Yeah, I mean, I think investors really do need to think about their total cost of ownership in these things. And yes, ETFs can be this amazing tool for lowering your total cost of ownership, but that is not to say that, you know, every mutual fund is awful, and it's not to say that everything should be priced at zero. I think there's a middle ground where we should all, as investors, evaluate what we're getting and decide whether or not we're paying appropriately for that, and paying for that in ways we understand. I mean, my favorite stat is that the value of a relationship with Schwab has been 25 basis points since the 70s. And you used to pay for that with $25 commissions. Now you probably pay for that in investment management fees. But that relationship has still averaged out to about 25 basis points of revenue going to Schwab. So you're going to pay something. It's just a question of whether you know it and whether you can control it.
Well, Dave, excellent insight as always. Always appreciate you joining us. We'll chat again next week. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
That was ETF.com's Dave Nottig. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by CFRA's Todd Rosenbluth. We'll continue discussing this topic of fees and what free really means, and we'll also get Todd's thoughts on the most recent round of ETF fee cuts from Vanguard. You're listening to ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime. Nate Geraci alongside Connor Kelly. We're now pleased to be joined by Todd Rosenbluth, Director of ETF and Mutual Fund Research at CFRA. Todd is on the line with us from New York. And I always say Todd is simply one of the best in the business at covering ETFs. And CFRA is one of the leading independent investment research providers. Todd, as always, great having you on the show.
Thanks, Nate. Good to be back with you and appreciate the kind words.
All right, Todd. So we're going to get into this discussion around SoFi zero-fee ETFs and certainly the Vanguard ETF fee cuts. But you and I haven't talked since the Inside ETFs conference in early February. And so I thought we might spend a few minutes on your takeaways. But before we do that, I have a surprise for you.
Oh, good.
And I have to point out to our listeners, you actually got up on stage at the conference in front of hundreds, I don't know, maybe 1,000 people, and you rapped about an ETF. And it's your lucky day. I scoured the interwebs to find a clip of this. So here goes your rap debut on ETF Prime.
When the market gets choppy and trades start to slow, better constructed boats perform best, Ben, don't you know? Screening for low debt leverage and profitability, CARP uses quality twice. But CFRA agrees many of the stocks inside the fund trade at a reasonable price. When our top-rated analytical team looks under the ETF hood, we think Boeing, Intel, Visa, and Walmart are still looking pretty good.
All right, so I have to ask you, have you ever actually rapped in your life before, let alone in front of 1,000 people?
So I'm not sure I still have. I think that was a poor man's attempt of trying to make a fool of himself on stage and do ETF education, but I've never done that before. I think, you know, Eric Balchunas has coined this effort that we've done on stage debating ETFs as an ETF rap battle. Some of my colleagues have done poems in the past and have done really cool laser shows and things to that effect. I just thought I had to try to bring it this year in an attempt to dethrone Matt Hogan, who unfortunately, for my sake, he won. But I felt like, you know, we did some good ETF education on stage and had a good time. And I think the audience hopefully learned something too.
Yeah, and to add some context, this was the annual Battle of ETF Pundits, where you compete with other ETF gurus, including Dave Noddick, who just joined us. So you each pitch the best new ETF of the past year. And I will say, I think everyone agrees you should have won without question, so we'll leave it
sure
at that.
I'm not sure Matt Hogan agrees with that one or the voters, but no, all in seriousness, I think it's a great way for the audience to get a sense of, one, what the seven of us do. How we compare and contrast our approaches to analyzing ETFs. Each of us looks at things from a different perspective, obviously has a different skill set that they try to show on stage. I think it also adds a bit of levity to a conference, which is an excellent conference, but a lot of it is asset managers up on stage making the case for their products, and you know, what we're doing is offering an independent perspective. You know, Dave, Eric, Matt, myself, Ben, you know, I won't go through the whole list of everybody, but I think it's a great event. I'm excited to be doing it year after year with the same crew.
Yeah, and quickly here, because I do want to get to the fee cuts, any major takeaways from the conference for you?
Well, I think what really stood out to me was, you know, actively managed ETFs have been percolating behind the scenes, particularly fixed income ETFs were very popular in 2018. But I think we saw asset managers that people are more familiar with in the mutual fund world raise their presence at this conference and educate investors that there doesn't need to be an index behind it. So we saw Davis, we saw PGIM, obviously PIMCO's been around for a number of years in the actively managed ETF space, other firms as well. I think that it's going to be a really exciting year for actively managed ETFs 2019.
No, I agree. That certainly stood out to me as well. All right, so let's move on. I want to first get your thoughts on the SoFi filing for four ETFs. Two of which would be offered for free after fee waivers. What was your take on this?
I think it's very exciting. I think I've been on beforehand talking that we were likely to see zero-fee ETFs in 2019. We put a call out there in December. If anybody wants to find that, the article is in the public domain at ETF.com. In mid-December, we published it on CFRA's MarketScope Advisor platform. In advance, we just were caught off guard as to who it would be. We named four different asset managers that have a presence that we thought could go to market. I think this is great. I think if you're going to crash the ETF party, you need to show up in a big way, and a zero fee
approach, I think, is compelling. I think it's going to garner investor interest. And I don't think, to get in front of where you may go on this, I don't think this is a gimmick. SoFi has made a compelling case for low-cost investing and low-cost banking for a number of years. And fee waivers are just a normal part of things. You know, there's many ETFs that are competitively priced that have a fee but are competitively priced because they have a fee waiver that has been renewed year after year after year.
So I'm sorry,
let me stop and let you join.
So to be clear, is your expectation that the fee waiver is going to remain in place?
I do think that we're going to see this certainly go beyond 2020. I think there's a greater likelihood, so as long as the money is coming into these products, that the fee waiver stays in place. I think, yeah, there's more likelihood that in 3 years, if this fails to gather assets, that these products don't exist, as opposed to the fee magically going from 0 to 19 basis points. And I think they're going to find some competition. There'll be other firms that will offer a zero-fee ETF in 2019. I think this opens the door and removes some of the potential stigma that might be out there.
All right, so right on the heels of the SoFi filings, we also learned last week that Vanguard chopped fees on a bunch of ETFs, including some of the most popular ETFs on the planet. So VOO, their S&P 500 ETF, VTI, the total U.S. stock market ETF, VWO, their emerging markets ETF. And one of the interesting aspects of these fee cuts was they only applied to the ETFs. So, of course, Vanguard's ETFs are a share class of their mutual funds, but these fee cuts only apply to the ETFs. What did you make of this?
So Vanguard has typically cut fees, or the fees have been, obviously, they're reviewed on an ongoing basis, based on an annual basis, based on the assets inside. So the fees came down for the ETF share classes, but not the Admiral share classes of the mutual funds, simply because money actually went in the door for the ETF share classes. I believe two of the three funds that you cited, the Admiral share class mutual fund version, the actual assets under management declined in 2018. Now, the funds declined in value, obviously, with the S&P 500 down, total stock market down, bonds essentially flat. But there was more money going into ETFs, and so I think it's reasonable that ETF shareholders get the benefits. I think you and the audience probably knows I'm a big advocate of going beyond the expense ratio, but when the index is the same as it is for the S&P 500 index, a basis point savings for VOO versus IVV is a big deal. They are essentially the same product tracking the same index with essentially the same liquidity, both on screen and behind screen. Why not pay less? There's other Vanguard fee cuts where it's much more than the basis point or two savings that investors would get. You know, we're talking about VWO, we're talking about VYM, and happy to go further, but you know, happy to, again, keep you in this conversation.
Hey, Todd, Connor Kelly. The first thing I thought of with the Vanguard fee cut announcements is, how do other smaller firms survive? I mean, it is very clear that the ETF universe is becoming one of massive scale necessary to survive with these ultra low fees. That I just would like your take on where this ends, right, with all of these other mid-tier and smaller tier providers out there that obviously do not and probably never will have the scale that a company like Vanguard has.
Yeah, you're definitely correct. So I think what we've seen is a bifurcation. So, you know, smaller asset managers that were later to the party or just don't have the scale are not likely to be launching a broadly diversified total stock market or total bond market or S&P 500 index-based approach. They're playing more in the thematic approaches, the actively managed approaches, other smart beta types, you know, they can offer something unique and proprietary. I do find it interesting that today, it's just coincidental that it's today, that Defiance has launched a thematic ETF, mm-hmm. FIVG, and it's 30 basis points that, you know, we typically find thematic-oriented ETFs. I think of Hack, or I think of Gamer, or I think of some of the Global X products that are 60, 70 basis points, even higher for that is. So this is they're trying to gain investor attention in a low-cost way. And I think that's why you have to do it. But hopefully they're able to gather assets to offset the cost of obviously coming in at 30 instead of 60 or above.
Yeah, I think I saw Eric Balchunas called it BlackRock repellent, right? Having the fee at that price point. Todd, what about for the larger fund companies? Because one of the takeaways I had from Inside ETFs, and I think I was wrong on this, was that the overall fee war was winding down. Just in visiting with several larger providers, I got the impression they are completely fatigued, and it was almost like they were hoping everyone would just play nice. But obviously between SoFi and Vanguard, and then we saw State Street come out with a lower cost junk bond ETF on Friday as well. Clearly that's not the case. So where does this all end for the larger companies, the companies with scale? What's the end game?
I think we're going to see pricing come down. I want to stay on that high yield one from State Street for a moment. They are taking an existing product, CJNK, which right now is a crossover a portfolio. So it invests in lower investment grade bonds and high yield bonds, so triple B and double B rated bonds, and they're converting to an index that is going to be only in the high yield, so double B, single B, and below, and basically be a cheaper alternative to their own JNK product. That's going to be the new product is going to be considerably less in price, and they're essentially competing with themselves, but because they want to have the money going to them instead of to iShares or to DWS that offers a low-cost, high-yield bond product, HYLB. I think it's nice to hope that competition levels out, but $3.8 trillion and counting in assets and likely to climb higher, I think we're going to see the big boys continue to be aggressive in all areas of the marketplace. So there's going to be no sacred cows. We've seen JP Morgan cut, you know, be aggressive in the single country space, which has been iShares' dominant area for a number of years. I don't think we're anywhere close to done in this competitive pressure. And I think that's great for investors.
Do you think we could see a negative fee ETF at some point?
Certainly, why not? I mean, right now we don't have any zero fee ETFs, but we think there'll be at least two, and if not more than two, in 2019. But I think listeners know you can make money through securities lending, and obviously you can make money surrounding the products as well. So I don't think it's going to happen in 2019, but I do think that in the next 10 years, certainly there'll be a product where you'll get rewarded for investing within their package as long as you're doing other things to help the company out, whether it's at Schwab or Fidelity or any other place that has a wrap fee that you can be a participant in.
All right, Todd, we have about 2 minutes left. One last area I wanted to touch on is the commission-free ETF platforms. So we recently saw both Fidelity and Schwab expand their offerings to, I think, around 500 ETFs. And these are typically pay-to-play, right? ETF providers have to pay a fee to be included on these platforms, which means it's a cost of operating an ETF, which, you know, theoretically gets passed on to shareholders. Do you view that as a problem, either in terms of transparency for investors or just that there's perhaps an uneven playing field for smaller ETF providers who don't have the same opportunity for product distribution?
Yeah, I actually think that the problem is as much as that investors are going to choose the easy button and they're going to see that commission-free list and only choose among those products. Now, the good thing is the list has expanded, so it's not just one product in an investment style or from one fund family, but you actually can compare and contrast and then determine which of these is better and then determine if you're not happy with the exposure you're getting, wanting to go with something and agree to pay the $4 or $5. You know, these are in commission. The commission cost is minimal compared to the difference that you find within. I'm less concerned that you need to be on the platform to get investor attention. It, you know, the zero fee products are not the ones that will end up there. There'll be products that are charging 30, 40 basis points that the asset manager wants to get investor attention for it. I just unfortunately think that that's the world we live in, and investors need to do their own homework to make sure they're getting the right choice, whether they use the research that we have at CFRA, the research that's available on ETF.com, others that are out there. There's lots of tools to compare and contrast beyond the home office decisions.
Well, Todd, I think that's the perfect note to end on. Really enjoyed chatting. Next time, you're going to have to rap live on the show.
God help us all.
Thank you for joining us today.
A pleasure, guys. Thanks a lot.
That was Todd Rosenbluth, Director of ETF and Mutual Fund Research at CFRA. And if you're on Twitter, certainly recommend giving Todd a follow. He's at ToddCFRA. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll spotlight a suite of ETFs focused on companies consistently growing dividends. We'll be joined by ProShare's Simeon Hyman. This is ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime. Let's go right to our ETF Spotlight.
It's time for the ETF Spotlight, where each week we highlight one exchange-traded fund. There are thousands of ETFs available to invest in. ETF Prime has sorted through them all, so you don't have to.
We're actually spotlighting a suite of ETFs this week. They come from ProShares, who currently offers over 140 ETFs altogether. There's nearly $30 billion invested in those ETFs. So ProShares has built out an entire suite of dividend ETFs, specifically ETFs focused on companies who have consistently grown dividends over longer periods of time. And we're now very pleased to have joining us via phone from New York, Simeon Hyman, Global Investment Strategist at ProShares. Simeon, great having you back on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Simeon, you know, it's interesting for investors who have been involved with ETFs for a while. I think a lot still equate ProShares to leveraged and inverse ETFs, but you have continued to really diversify your lineup. You now offer an S&P 500 bond ETF, an online retail ETF. Obviously, the Dividend Growers suite will spotlight here today. What's been the approach to new launches over the past several years?
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. Of that $30 billion, we've got well over $7 billion that are sort of, for us, regular, you know, buy-and-hold strategies. Although, to your point, regular for us is sort of not regular for everybody else. In other words, we're not in the business of playing market cap-weighted ETFs. We're looking for what I think is best described as rules-based strategies. You know, strategies that do seek to provide outperformance, different characteristics that can complement or even serve as important core holdings. The Dividend Growers are a big piece of that, S&P bond and some thematic offerings, you know, that all offer the opportunity to play an important role in client portfolios that are beyond the important leverage and inverse offerings that were the inception of the firm.
Well, let's talk about the Dividend Growers suite. The flagship product here is the ProShares S&P 500 Dividend Aristocrats ETF, ticker symbol NOBL, Noble, great ticker. Walk us through the basics here. What's the strategy?
So Noble is focused on companies. It follows the S&P 500 Dividend Aristocrats Index. And that is the subset of the S&P 500 whose companies have grown their dividends for a minimum of 25 years. So that's a really long track record of consistent growth of dividends. And you know what you get when you use that type of screen are very high quality companies. You know, you can't be over-levered. You can't have very cyclical performance. You need to have consistency of growth of cash flow, of earnings, all the good stuff, good balance sheet metrics that would allow you to both deliver that increased dividend over time and give investors the confidence that that's likely to continue going forward.
So to give our listeners a flavor, who are some of the companies they might find in this ETF?
Yeah, so some of the companies that you might find in the ETF, and particularly as we go, you know, across even capitalization, and I like to give some sort of surprises in there too, because you know, the strategy, you know, goes across mid and large cap too. So we also have ticker REGL, which is our mid cap strategy, and also SMDV, which is small cap. So, you know, you even get some surprises in there, like a Tootsie Roll, as the smaller companies actually have a consistent approach to delivering dividends too, which is sometimes a surprise to folks because you're often focused on only having companies. You associate the strategy with large cap companies, but indeed there are smaller ones in the universe too that offer very interesting complements to portfolios, in addition to the well-known strategy of following those companies in the large cap space.
With Noble, how many total holdings, how many companies have met this criteria of growing dividends for at least 25 consecutive years?
So we actually had a bumper crop of new holdings. Four were added this year, so we're up to 57. And a couple of the names that, you know, recently made the cut include People's Bank and United Technologies. So a couple of new entrants in sort of our class of 2019. But there's not a lot of turnover because you really don't get a lot of companies going in and out of the index. But there were a few that that made the cut this year.
Simeon, this is Connor Kelly. Following up on that, this is a fairly focused fund with, you know, less than 60 holdings in it. Where do you see this fitting in a portfolio? What is the typical investor that you see using these dividend-focused, you know, high-quality ETFs you guys offer?
We see them really as core holdings, and let me explain why I think that's the case. You know, when you think about, and back to, you know, some of the high-quality names like Coca-Cola and others that are in the back to your original question of the large-cap holdings, you know, they resonate with folks, so they're easy to explain. But from a performance standpoint, they work as a buy-and-hold strategy because of the consistency of performance. You know, they're not deep value stocks, nor are they extreme growth stocks. They sit in the middle of the style box, and the consistency comes through. So, for example, let's look at Q4, which was a very rough quarter for investors. The S&P was down 13.5%. The S&P 500 Dividend Aristocrats and Noble ETF down just about 8.5%. So significant defensive qualities. But, of course, the defensiveness in and of itself, if that was all the strategy offered, would require you to have sort of your finger on the trigger in terms of timing. You'd need to, you know, kind of go in and out of a strategy that was simply defensive. But the dividend growth strategies fit as a core holding because they also offer very nice upside participation when markets are going up. Because this isn't just a story of quality, it's also a story of quality plus growth because those dividends are growing. So with these strategies across the board, you're getting nearly all of the market upside, but with substantial downside protection, and that allows you to have these as important core holdings that can offer solid performance, enhanced performance, and even some volatility mitigation. So, you know, right in the center of the of core holdings across the equity segment.
Simeon, this is maybe more of an investor behavior question, but if the data shows us this dividend grower strategy works, I guess, number one, why isn't everyone doing it? And then two, if everyone does do it, does that impact the ability of the strategy to work moving forward?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. This is, you know, kind of the old economist question that, you know, anytime you see two economists walk down the street and there's a $100 bill on the ground and neither of them pick it up because, of course, somebody would have picked it up before them and they just walk by it. So you can put yourself in kind of a death spiral of believing none of these opportunities exist, but sometimes they do. And in this case, there are a couple of reasons, but one of my favorites is it's almost a little bit akin to kind of earnings surprise. You know, when a company increases its dividend, it's a major, major commitment because the last thing you want to do is cut a dividend. Companies that cut their dividends are, across the board, the worst performers in the equity market. So, you know, when those dividends are increased, that's just a little bit of extra indication that prospects for those companies are just a little bit better than you thought they were before. I could list another bunch of reasons why we think the outperformance is persistent for so long a period of time, but that's one that always catches my eye, that they're always just almost, it's kind of an oxymoron, but they're consistently doing a little bit better than you expect.
You mentioned earlier ProShares also offers a mid and small cap U.S. version of the strategy. I know there's also a developed international and emerging market version. Are these all effectively the same strategy, just using different stock universes?
Yeah, they're all focused on the longest track record of dividend growth across their sleeve. So, and the only difference being the minimum number of years to qualify. So with the S&P 500 Dividend Aristocrats Noble, it's a 25-year commitment. REGL is our mid-cap strategy with 15 years, and the Russell 2010 and the MSCI EAFE Dividend Growers, EFAD ticker, 10 years. So all the same strategy. The stocks within these portfolios are all equally weighted. That's really the best way to get that, to elicit the best outperformance from the screen itself. And the performance is similar across the board. In fact, if you look at SMDV, our small cap dividend grower, you know, as tough as Q4 was in the S&P 500, small caps were down 20% in the fourth quarter, and the Russell 2000 dividend growth index was down just 8%. So again, quite defensive, but also pretty reasonable participation on the upside. So, you know, we'd encourage folks again to look, you know, beyond just Noble and its sort of obvious constituents of the large cap blue chips that you might imagine are there, but also look across capitalization and internationally as well.
All right, Simin, we have a few minutes left here, and we spent a decent chunk of our show today talking these fee wars, fee compression across the ETF space. And if you don't mind, I'd love to get your thoughts on this topic. I know ProShares, your products are more differentiated, as you were alluding to earlier. You're not offering plain vanilla ETFs. But do you have any thoughts on what we're seeing? You know, potentially zero-cost ETFs, companies fighting over a basis point or two. How do you view all this?
Well, yeah, for plain market cap weighted indices, almost the only differentiator is fee. So I think that's understandable in the current environment. As I mentioned earlier, you know, we're focused on differentiated strategies that are really, from our perspective, kind of the cutting edge of security and stock selection. So all these strategies, they're picking stocks. You know, you mentioned that they're not super concentrated, but we're really picking stocks. 57 out of the S&P 500 is a stock-picking strategy. You know, just over 60 out of 2,000 in our Russell 2000 dividend ETF, dividend growth ETF, SMDV. So they're really replacing and competing against far more expensive actively managed mutual funds and separately managed accounts. And there we think that we've, you know, really put together a very compelling value proposition.
Putting the fee discussion aside, I'm curious, where do you see white space in ETFs? Just broadly speaking, where could product innovation come from moving forward?
Well, I think there's still some innovation available in rules-based strategies because that's an evolving universe. Some people like to call it smart beta. I prefer rules-based strategies, ideas that come from sometimes from academia that do allow for persistent outperformance or persistent pieces of portfolio construction that are useful, but also in the world of thematics, that's also a space where we see some room to find some niches, such as our retail disruption suite and our recently launched pet care ETF, ticker PAWZ. So some little niches there in thematics that can add some satellite opportunity for portfolios, but also some opportunities for innovation in rules-based strategies in the core space as well.
All right. And then just lastly, I mentioned at the top that ProShares has focused on leverage and inverse ETFs in the past. I'm just curious, do you think education around those products has improved over the years? I know early on there was a lot of concern about whether or not, especially retail investors, knew what they were buying. Do you feel like that education has improved?
Yeah, we're certainly very focused on education. So, you know, for those who are interested in learning more about leverage and ETFs, how they operate, how to use them in portfolios, we have lots and lots of resources on our website, and we do think it's really, really important that people avail themselves of those and educate themselves appropriately. They're really powerful and effective tools, but you do want to make sure that you're fully educated on how to deploy them.
Well, Simin, really enjoyed the discussion today. Thank you for joining us.
Appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
That was Simin Hyman, Global Investment Strategist at ProShares. And you can learn more about their entire ETF lineup by visiting ProShares.com. Connor, we have just about a minute left here. I want to go back to this whole fee discussion we've had. You know, it's interesting hearing from a provider like ProShares. They're almost on the opposite end of the spectrum. They're not worried about this at all. Certainly, they're paying attention to what their funds cost, and they need to be competitive. But it's just such an interesting contrast from the Vanguards and iShares and State Streets of the world. Scrapping over basis points.
Yeah, they're both extremes here, right? The pure beta, Vanguard, 2 or 3 basis points. And then I think Simin explained it very well. Look, there's alpha here in terms of maybe lower volatility, different performance. But when you're talking about we own 57 of the S&P 500 500 stocks or 60 of the Russell 2000, you're paying what you're getting for. And that is active management, right? It could be rules-based, but you are not getting the Russell 2000, the S&P 500, and people are willing to pay for that. So I think he did a very good job explaining that difference. And look, when you're paying your fees to these ProShares ETFs, you are getting differentiation. These are not closet indexers. They're the opposite of that. These are very focused ETFs that they have launched.
But he also said something that I thought was really important when I asked him about fees. You know, they view themselves as competing against actively managed mutual funds.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't, you know, they're not trying to compete in the plain vanilla beta space.
No, they're not.
And so, you know, I mentioned this with Dave. I mean, that's where I think we don't want to lose the forest for the trees, in that there are still a lot of extremely pricey actively managed mutual funds out there, a number of which are really just closet index funds. They don't have that higher active share. And, you know, all the other investment products we talk about, annuities, hedge funds, so on and so forth. So in any event, we'll have to leave it there. I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, Legg Mason. You can visit leggmason.com to learn more about their broad range of investment strategies. Podcasts of ETF Prime are available at etfprime.com, etf.com, iTunes, and Spotify. You can follow me on Twitter at Nate Geraci. Next week, we'll talk bond ETFs in the current bond market with Jillian Del Signor, head of ETF distribution at J.P. Morgan. And then we'll look at several Global X ETFs with Jay Jacobs, who's head of research and strategy there. Until then, have a great week, everyone.